Welcome to the third in the IEA's Zeroing In Free Market Approaches to the 2050 Target series. I'm your host, Darren Grimes. Over the last three decades, governments have repeatedly set targets, often for their successors or their successor's successor, which may be missed, but then replaced by more ambitious targets. Does solving the climate problem require a restructuring of the energy sector and agriculture, which will take many decades, of course? And if so, will 2050 be another target, just another target, that passes us by? Are politicians, many of whom have shared platforms with environmental activists, saying one thing and failing to do another? What are the free market solutions to climate change and pollution? Would a carbon tax disproportionately hurt the poor? Our first guest on this series, Kingsmill Bond from Carbon Tracker, was entirely optimistic that the market has already provided us with the foundations we need to achieve net zero carbon emissions by the 2050 target, which is enshrined in law. Our second guest, Richard Toll, Professor of Economics at Sussex University, has argued for carbon taxes in the past. He acknowledges that while it involves government intervention, it also leaves people and companies free to reorganise lives, production and consumption. It is, he says, a more effective way of regulating CO2 emissions than any other. So let's find out what our third guest thinks. Dr. Jamie White is a classical liberal academic and author of Crimes Against Logic. The first question is very simple, actually. What is your view of the net zero target? If you consider, actually, that the average lifetime of a coal-fired plant is 50 years, is it even achievable?
It's probably achievable if there was the absolute political will to do it. I mean, remember that it's a net zero emissions. So that means that you can still have emissions, but they've got to be offset by something like, you know, I don't know, planting a forest or what have you. So it could be done. I agree with you, though, that it will be very difficult and it will require incredible political will. And whether or not our politicians have that will, I'm not sure. I mean, the law was passed in an incredibly glib fashion, and it was hardly debated at all.
Yeah.
Just went through on the nod. And so it hasn't. Most politicians haven't really thought through what they were signing up to. But so there's one question, will it or can it be achieved? The other one is, should it be achieved? And that's where I have a profound disagreement with this policy. And they're thinking about it in the wrong way, I think, about the issue of climate change. Climate change, supposing, let's not dabble with skepticism here, let's suppose that it is happening. It has costs and it has some benefits, but let's suppose that it's on net costly. Well, stopping it is also costly. And if you want to approach this so that the cost of stopping it doesn't exceed the benefits of stopping it. And the right approach to this is try to work out, well, what are the benefits of stopping it? Or to put it the other way around, just equivalent, how much would it cost if we had it? You know, how bad would it be? Work out what that amount is, and therefore you kind of put what you might call a price on the emission of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. And then once you've got that price, that external cost, as it's known in economics. By external cost, we just mean that it's a cost not borne solely by the emitter. It's a cost borne by everybody. And because the emitter doesn't bear the cost himself, he's likely to emit more than he should. So we want to work out what cost he's imposing on other people. And then the way to get to the right situation with all these things is to apply a tax, a so-called Pigouvian tax, equal to that external cost. Then people will emit carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases only when the benefit to them is greater than the total cost, including the external cost to other people, because we've added that cost in with the tax. Now, suppose you did that. It's very difficult to work out what that cost is. The estimates at the moment range from, at the lower end, I think about $40 per ton of emitted CO2, up to more like 400, 500, right? So there's a big range. It's a very difficult problem to work out because, of course, there are benefits, as I said, as well as costs, and so you're trying to work out the net cost. But anyway, let's suppose it were 100, just a nice round number, $100. So then the emitters, anyone who emits, factories or power stations, as they're producing carbon dioxide emissions, they pay this tax, right? And if it's still worthwhile to them to do it, then it's a sign that they should do it. The benefits of doing it exceed the total costs, including the cost to climate change. Now, suppose you have followed that approach rather than what we're going to, you might find that people still wanted, it was still worthwhile to have gross emissions. That's to say, the benefits of some climate change and some emissions exceeded the cost of trying to get rid of it, and it was still worthwhile. So we don't know in advance what the optimal level of carbon emissions is. There's a really interesting issue here. I'm going to flag it and then leave viewers to think about it for themselves. Suppose that the right Pigouvian tax for emitting a ton of CO2, well, let's split the difference. Let's say that it's $200 per ton. It turns out that at that level, which I say is higher than the official number now, the official number is more like $50. That's the one that I think governments have worked out of. But anyway, let's suppose 200. If you wanted to apply that to a liter of petrol, so what would it mean in terms of tax on extra tax on a liter of petrol? It would mean about 35p, right? So if it's 200, the external cost, then the Pigouvian tax on a liter of petrol should be about 35p. Well, as it happens, petrol in the United Kingdom is already taxed very highly. In fact, the tax is 58p. So this means that now, it wasn't intended for this purpose, right? The taxes on petrol weren't introduced as a response to climate change, but that's irrelevant. People are already having their consumption of petrol reduced. They're paying that tax, right? So, in theory, we're already doing a suboptimal amount of driving on our cars because the tax is higher than the Pigouvian tax would be. The normal sales tax on it, or excise duty, whatever you want to call it, is higher already than the Pigouvian tax. This is a very when you've got sales taxes, VAT in the UK, you've got reduced consumption going on already. So when you start to say, well, they've got reasons we want to reduce consumption, like these external things, you've got to ask yourself, well, hang on, but aren't we all if the 20% VAT is already higher than the Pigouvian tax would be, then maybe there's no reason to apply an extra Pigouvian tax. We may already be beyond the optimal level of tax. Right, so I just.
Yeah, no, that is an interesting way to put it. I mean, we'll get on to one of the taxes proposed in a minute, but do you think if we turn to coronavirus for a second, do you think it's a folly to actually mix climate change and coronavirus and ask why there has been such public willingness to relinquish civil liberties or luxuries of everyday life essentials to prevent the spread of this virus, but not to tackle what many argue? And you didn't yourself, you don't deny the science. Many scientists seem to agree that this is happening and it's serious. Why is there no real desire to tackle this supposedly deadly change in our climate?
Well, I mean, you could say that the standard answer to that question is that people are irrational. Daniel Kahneman said in an interview, oddly, with The Spectator, said that people not kind of adopting the, they're not sufficiently anxious about climate change because the threat is in the distant future, and we're irrational about threats that are in the distant future. Whereas the coronavirus threat's immediate. People are dying now in hospitals. That might be part of the answer, but another part of the answer might be that there's a rational difference here, which is that climate change moves slowly. And it's not just that it's way off in the future, it's that we can adapt to it. And the adaptation to it may be less costly than trying to stop it. And of course, you might take that view about coronavirus as well. You might say that we're overreacting to the threat of coronavirus and that we could, that if there weren't a shutdown, for example, people would voluntarily take all sorts of actions to avoid, they don't want to get it, they don't want to pass it to their elderly relatives and so on. We'd probably get more of it than we will get with the lockdown, but people will be able to make their own trade-offs about what is and isn't worth it, what is and isn't essential. The government now has said they've decided what's essential, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, maybe they're wrong. They've got their views about what's essential. I've got my views about what's essential. And it may be that there's a mistake in the policy around coronavirus. I've been following, as you can imagine, a lot of the debates on this, and it's really very tricky to understand what's the right answer. But I think the main difference is a sense of immediacy and urgency, whereas we can adapt to the changes in the climate. So I would say that's the difference.
Speaking of that adaptation, some environmentalists have claimed, especially during this crisis actually, that climate change is a crisis of capitalism and free markets. And actually, the government's response to coronavirus suggests that it isn't capitalism or free markets that we need. How do you think we challenge that consensus?
Well, what causes climate change is emissions of greenhouse gases. And what causes the emission of greenhouse gases is not capitalism as such. It's modern production techniques, factories, cars, planes. Now, when you have a very successful economy, high levels of production and output, you get more cars and planes and factories and all the good stuff that comes out of them. And, you know, if you had a communist regime that were successful in the way that many communists say they would be successful, I mean, I don't believe them, but they say they would be successful in creating high levels of output and flourishing human beings, they'd have exactly the same problem. They've still got smoke coming out of factories. They've still got planes buzzing around and all this same stuff. So it's not obvious to me at all what connection there is between capitalism and greenhouse gas emissions, other than the fact that capitalism is very successful at having high levels of output. And in fact, there are reasons to believe that we have problems with carbon emissions and environmental problems generally, insofar as we deviate from capitalist principles around private property. So one thing you can observe is that most of the things that get polluted in the world, the places that get polluted, are places that aren't privately owned. Mm. So people don't fly tip on their own back lawn, right? They fly tip in public spaces. The manager of the factory doesn't dump all the effluent into his own home or even into the factory. He dumps it into a river somehow, and the river isn't owned and policed. If I'm very much in favor of private ownership of waterways, and the owners could then sell permits to pollute the water up to a certain point, they might want none at all. Fishermen could buy the permits so that they could fish in it instead. But then you would get a management of these matters. Now, and it turns out that if you look at communist countries, they've been terrible polluters.
Yes.
Why, right? Well, because there's nobody there to object. There's no one who owns the land who says, you're wrecking my land. You can't do that. I can take you to court. Because there's no private ownership, there are very few people with intense incentives to stop pollution. And in a funny way, the cap and trade approach to limiting emissions is a private property style solution to the problem of pollution. So it says implicitly, it kind of suggests that the state or somebody in some vague sense owns the air. And if you want to stick your dirty stuff in it, you've got to buy a permit, and the permit has a price. So it's kind of mimicking what would happen if there were private ownership of the air. So I don't think there's any connection between any interesting connection between capitalism and climate change. Nor do I think that the solutions to climate change lie in less capitalism. And on coronavirus, just since we can't avoid talking about it, the question is, again, it's not really capitalism as such that's caused this. It's the free movement of people around the world. I mean, I suppose that it was mainly tourists from China that brought, got Italy, for example, brought the coronavirus to Italy. Not so much the goods that we import from China. I think that it was Chinese people, as my understanding. Now, again, the movement of people around the world, this is just something that human beings on the whole want. We want to be able to fly cheaply somewhere else and visit it as a tourist or on a business trip if we want to. And so if you were to introduce a socialist kind of regime, well, okay, maybe there would be less of that traveling around, but that would only be because we were worse off, right? And then think of the response to the crisis. Well, we are importing medical equipment from all around the world. Of course, it's in short supply at the moment, but supply will be able to ramp up very rapidly and is ramping up very rapidly. And I think that it's been impressive. I think you look at this. I mean, again, pandemics come along every now and then. They're not the creation of capitalism. And the question is a rich capitalist country in a better position to respond with globalization than a country living under some alternative system? And so, since all the alternative systems have left us poorer, have had far less efficient production, it seems crazy to me to suggest that capitalism is somehow the problem here.
I mean, speaking about being poorer, a devastating side effect, obviously, of coronavirus, will be that government, or rather the taxpayer, is in much greater debt. So if we have to tax something, why don't we start with carbon?
Oh, you're really desperate to link coronavirus and climate change. There's always a funny with Pigouvian taxes. What you're trying to do on the whole is, well, you want to reduce to the activity that's being taxed on the whole, and certainly when it's not being approached in the Pigouvian way, when the people just slap on an arbitrary level of tax to try to discourage something, as with cigarettes, let's say, or alcohol. These aren't really measures aimed at raising revenue for the government. They're really measures aimed at reducing the activity in question. And insofar as they're successful, they'd raise no revenue at all. I mean, if I said I really don't want people going to the movies anymore, movies are dreadful business, so we're going to add a £100 tax onto movie tickets. Well, that would be if immediately effective. Nobody would go to the movies, and the government would raise no revenue from it. So, insofar as these taxes are successful, they're not very good ways of raising revenue. Now, actually, interestingly, when I'm talking about petrol taxes, petrol taxes are a great way of raising revenue because it turns out that the consumption of petrol is not very sensitive to the price of it. So you can put up the price of petrol a lot and people don't much reduce their driving. So it's a very good way for the government to raise revenues. So these two goals of taxation to change behavior and to raise revenue are directly at odds with one another. Because the best things to tax from the point of view of raising revenue are things that don't stop when you tax them. So I don't think that's the right way to think about carbon taxes as a good way of coming up with money. I mean, you might say that actually the carbon taxes won't change people's behavior that much, and that may change a little bit. And so it is a kind of a good way of raising revenue. Because you tax people who act badly, and so it's kind of a justice in it, or something like that. But that's again a kind of I don't want to get into arguments like that.
I mean, most advocates of these taxes of carbon taxes want it to be revenue neutral. They want to cut other taxes by the same amount. And the point is, to them, I think they'd argue, not to raise money, it's to make low carbon activities more attractive relative to high carbon activities. You well, don't seem to agree with that yet. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you think about what's taxed, so if my income is taxed, that discourages me from working. I guess working is, some kinds of working are carbon positive. Most are, I suppose. If insofar as you've got a carbon tax, it automatically makes the things that are carbon intensive more expensive relative to other things. So if we think of it all just in sales tax terms, it will immediately have that impact, and it will encourage producers to find low carbon ways of making things, or people consuming close alternatives that are lower carbon. Absolutely, and that's all built into that. That's what makes these either taxes or the cap and trade method, we have to buy permits, effective ways of getting people to change their behavior to reduce. But what I'm saying is that insofar as they're effective in that sense, which is what they're intended to do, they become less effective ways of raising revenue, because people are avoiding the tax.
Yes.
By changing their behavior, they're avoiding the tax, and so the tax revenues are not so high. That's why I said, from a tax-raising point of view, if that's your goal, then the fact that you can avoid these taxes by changing your behavior makes the tax not a very good one. If you're trying to raise revenue, you want a tax where people can't easily avoid it by changing their behavior.
But we have all of this carbon in our lives because of 200 years of technological advancement that has actually enriched our lives. I think we forget that far too easily. But can we not now depend on that same technology to actually find a solution to reducing our carbon output?
Do you mean, can't we hope that there'll be technological breakthroughs?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, of course, if you tax the carbon, if you make carbon emitting technology more expensive, that creates an incentive for innovators to come up with alternatives that emit less carbon. So the tax in itself creates an incentive. So that's good. Hopefully that will work. There's another idea going around, which is that instead of taxes, there should be subsidies for the production of the alternatives. So you give huge sums of money to scientists, you know, kind of inventor types, to see what they can come up with. The reason I'm reluctant, I prefer the tax approach, and it's just because I fear that whenever there are billions being thrown around in subsidies, you get a lot of corruption and cronyism, and money just being wasted, and huge numbers of people being drawn into research programs that are silly. Whereas if you've got, if you have a tax which changes the price, gets you to pay the real price of high emission technology, you create the incentive that I mentioned before to come up with, but you don't corrupt that process. So the people who are trying to come up with the alternative technologies, they face the normal risks of anyone doing this, and they're not getting taxpayers' money and just blowing it. They're still got to be serious.
Yeah.
And so I prefer that way of going about the business.
Well, I think that actually does sound like the ideal route out of all of this, because, as we say, the political appetite for doing something is clearly there, right? And if something is to be done, we need it to be the least harmful to the wider economy and, well, society, I guess.
Absolutely. And the least distorting of our choices. If you just apply a tax equal to the external cost and leave everything else alone, we can make our own decisions about whether we want to pay that tax and bear that cost, but keep doing certain things or not. There's other approaches, like, for example, banning petrol cars. All cars are going to have to be electric by a certain date.
Yeah.
Well, that's making the decision for us, and it may not be the decision that suits a lot of people, and better to just make them pay for the cost of their decisions and leave them alone. So the reason I think a lot of free market economists prefer the Pigouvian tax approach to many other approaches is because it's the least interventionist and the least distorting of individuals' decisions. If we've got a little time left, I think you want to keep wanting to connect up the coronavirus pandemic problem and climate change. And this is really, I'm just asking questions aloud here. I don't know what the results will be. But if you think one of the most amazing things, and you brought it up earlier, is how obedient the population has been in following the lockdown, and how willing politicians have been to impose massive economic costs for this purpose. I'm not saying they shouldn't, I'm not saying it's net wrong, but it's been dramatic, really dramatic, and as has the response of the people. So you think, well, okay, we're going to come out of this with a lot more public debt, and that what that might normally make you think that governments will go for some kind of austerity again, right? Where they have to cut government spending, they have to try to pay down this debt, they probably have to put up taxes. It's all, but it'll be kind of a, they'll be chastened by it in a certain sense. They'll be constrained by it. That's the way of putting it. So they'll be constrained by it. Maybe, maybe not. Having witnessed the ease with which they can do something sort of so dramatic, they may be tempted to do it more. This may be a kind of turning point, and they may have opened their eyes and said, my God, we can do whatever we want. We can just tell the population, this is a terrible emergency, you have to stay indoors forever, you can't. I mean, for example, emissions will be down at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know which way it's going to go. I don't know. I'm terribly worried that they may be very encouraged by this. And it makes me happy that Boris Johnson's the prime minister, because I think that he's far from perfect, but I do think that he is not a natural authoritarian.
Yeah.
He wants to leave, he wants people to be left alone to get on with their lives. I think that's it's more of a gut feeling in him, I think, than a political philosophy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could see that in his early response to the pandemic. He didn't really want to, it went against his grain. So I'm very relieved that it's him and not somebody who loves the exercise of government authority who we're going to get for the next 4 years.
Yeah. I mean, we were discussing earlier the fact that this, what we're experiencing right now, is basically the Green Party's manifesto, which is zero to negative growth and, you know, no food on shelves. So
I haven't been following them, but I wonder, I mean, are some of them, you're more of a social media guy than me, are some of them saying that this is great?
Well, some of them are saying that actually this goes to show why capitalism is in crisis. So whatever that means, you can interpret that however way you want, I guess.
Well, capitalism has been temporarily stopped.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yeah. Put on ice.
But maybe they do like this. I mean, I was going for a jog through Regent's Park the other day, and, you know, it was lovely, beautiful weather, and fewer people than you would normally see in there. And, you know, the cherry blossoms were out. And I realized, well, of course, my income's been cut now. But on the other hand, I'm spending less. And I thought, you know, so this is a little bit like what a constrained production and consumption existence would be like under a kind of green environment. And I had a moment's thought before I kicked myself. I said, it's not that bad.
Oh, dear.
It's shameful, isn't it? No, but by the way, it didn't last long. I'm now dying to get back to the pub.
Yeah, well, you and me both, you and me both. Like Vera Lynn said, though, we shall meet again. Anyway, I think that's the perfect moment to end that. Thank you very much, Jamie, for taking the time to speak to the IEA today.
Thank you for having me on.